gathered music from the Navajo people of the southwest of the United States and from Mali in West Africa. Welcome to another edition of Critical Thinking. I'm Andrew Patner, your host and producer for this series. Today, we're going to take the first part of a two-part walk through the new galleries of Indian Art of the Americas and African Art at the Art Institute of Chicago. New permanent galleries, the first after a long and interesting, we think, saga of collecting and deciding how to, when to, where to display these remarkable works of art. It is in the lower level of the Morton Wing. You know where the spiral staircase is? The south wing of the museum, as you are looking down there on the old Illinois Central Railroad tracks. Well, that's where we're going to take up our walk. I'm introducing our walkthrough on Halloween night, October 31st, with a bit of a heads up, I guess is the contemporary term. We originally had planned to air these programs a couple of weeks ago. We had some opportunities with Maestro Muti and Maestro Haitink, so we had to delay it a bit. And part two, more on the African wing, we talk about a truly remarkable textile made from the golden threads of a spider, a lot of spiders, millions of spiders, from Madagascar, a contemporary work. And this textile, for reasons that we get to in today's program, is only on view through Sunday, November 6th. So I want to give you this heads up before you nod out, fade out, tune out, that the spiders and their work, especially their work, are there for you for only this one week. And now we'll just drop in to our discussion, the beginning of our discussion, with Richard Townsend, chairman of the department, and his colleague Kathleen Bickford-Burzok, curator of African art. My recollection was that over time, obviously there are many name changes and so on, but that the department was African and Indian and Oceanic.
And an even more primeval state, it was the Department of Primitive Art.
Right, right.
Way back in the early 1960s. Mm-hmm. And then it changed to Africa, Oceania, and the Americas. But 25 years ago or more, we decided to not do Oceania. There was not a large amount of pieces, but we deaccessioned them and concentrated instead on African and Indian art of the Americas as an area of growth and collecting, and also because we have large populations in Chicago that stem from those origins, and so we thought that would be appropriate to do.
So the history of even the name of the department actually does contain some mm-hmm. history of the department and also mm-hmm. history of attitudes and terminology yeah. about different peoples right. and different parts of the world.
Right. It was then, after Department of Primitive Art, then it became Africa, Oceania, and the Americas. Then it became African and Amerindian art, mm-hmm. using an old-fashioned term that I thought might it'd be more succinct than saying of the Americas and so on and so forth. But people still don't know what that means, and they still stumble over it. So I realized that that was going nowhere, so we reverted to Indian Art of the Americas.
Was there any internal or external debate or discussion about the issue of Native American or, in Canada, First Nations, Indian, American Indian, and how was the yeah. decision reached then?
Well, there was some soul-searching and debate, principally with myself, but those terms, Native American art or Canada First Nations, that kind of approach, that gets it even more extended out, because that only really applies then to the United States or Canada, and we're really doing the Indian art of the Americas, right. from the archaeological times to the fairly recent times. So we wanted to have a title that would embrace it all, the continental.
And it really is continental because the collection includes works that go all the way up to Alaska and Aleutian areas and all the way down to...
Well, let us say that as an area of potential growth, it could do that. But at present, it really starts with the United States and a little bit of the ancient Midwest and Southeast, just a touch, which we hope to amplify, then the Southwest, and then Mexico, Central America, and the Andean countries of South America, Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia.
And the time span is 4 millennia?
The earliest things we have are really from our own Midwestern region, and they are from 4,000 to 6,000 BC.
Wow. So with gaps over time, we're talking about 8,000 years.
Approximately, yes. Round numbers.
And how does Africa compete with that in terms of these collections? The focus historically is probably Western Africa and Central Africa, but over time additional things have been added. And is that right? And what's the time frame?
Yeah, that's a fair representation. The sort of canonical approach to collecting African art in American art museums has been to focus on the large-scale figural sculpture and masks from West and Central Africa, and that does form the core or the base of our collection, which formally started in the 1950s. We do have a couple pieces that the museum had from the 1920s and 30s that are on view. Over that, let's see, 50-year period, the field has constantly been broadening itself. And so in the 1970s, you started seeing more decorative arts being added to the collection. And by the 1990s, we were really looking at wanting to be much more diverse in the representation of art from the African continent, and sort of started making a concerted effort to include, when appropriate, works from northern Africa, where they can be associated with what's happening in northern sub-Saharan Africa, as well as works from eastern and southern Africa, areas that had been largely unrepresented in the collection. And so the new presentation in this gallery, which is three times larger than the space we had before, is very very inclusive across the continent, and as well as being diversified in terms of the types of objects on view. So not just figures and masks, but also jewelry and ceramics and furniture and some textiles and some regalia and all sorts of things. So it's a much broader look at the sort of history of aesthetic expression from that continent.
You have, just by enumerating those things, raised all kinds of interesting areas for discussion, and there literally are books written about when, why, and how art museums collect these things, and how other museums of ethnography or natural history have collected these things, and how, once collected, these works are studied and shown. But let's jump ahead to 2011, because a reason for our talking about these things now is how they're being shown. And Richard Townsend, you've been at the museum now for a while?
Since 1982.
And you've been in the field since?
I was about 7 years old, or just eight, when my parents moved to Mexico from Washington, D.C. area. My father was a photographer. He'd worked in the National Gallery of Art, and then mom was a writer of children's books, very successful in the 30s, and both had, even before they were married or knew each other, they had a history of travels in Latin America, and so they resolved to move to Mexico in 1947. So on their agenda was to visit ruins and museums and folk art fairs and all of that, and they continued to live there the rest of their days. So I think what I do stems from that. When I began school at the University of New Mexico and the University of the Americas in Mexico City, It took a while to kind of define a career out of it, because insofar as art history goes, there were only one or two places on the map that dealt with this in terms of dealing with the aesthetic and symbolic aspect of all of this. There were plenty of anthropology departments, but not really in art history. And so at first I did a lot of anthropology courses and so forth, and not until much later at graduate school, years later at Harvard, was I able to find someone who really could guide the development of an art historical approach to it all.
And it's perhaps, I hope, fair to say that throughout all of that, as you developed your areas of interest, and then at museums and at this museum developed the way things were shown, the way things were discussed, gave us a number of major international special exhibitions on the art of the Americas and of specific parts, and surveys of Mexico and of other areas and of our own Midwest, as you alluded to earlier, and its history. You've also been, I imagine, waiting for the time when there would be a physical space around the year and around the years where there would be sufficient room, not to show everything, of course, but to have regular exhibition, and also because many of these pieces are so old, to be able to show them in a way that was supportive of the material and protective of the material. And so to have these spaces, and maybe we can just talk about these two new spaces, or do you view it as one space with several rooms? Or
we've had, since I've been here, two, three locations before this. And I was offered, when I first came, still a fourth place, which I elected not to take. But this is the really triumph, finally, of falling heir to a wonderful set of galleries in the what's called the Lower Morton wing of the Art Institute that formerly was occupied by modern and contemporary art. Now they've moved to a new wing, and so this fell available to us. And we've really divided it in half and split this large space with one gallery for the Americas and the other for African art. And it gave us the chance, both Kathleen and I collaborated very closely with the architects and designers and fabricators of cases to develop a very clear sort of modernist presentation of the things that would allow the objects to be seen with the greatest possible clarity and in a very selective manner, and also equipped each gallery with videos, ongoing videos that are projected onto the screen, large scale, without sound. They're essentially silent or with a minimal kind of slightly musical but not invasive sound to help give a sense of context to these works of art, showing various kinds of ritual events, architectural settings, and so forth, fundamental themes to which the art points.
You use the phrase, and you use it rightly and aptly, I think, a modernist presentation, and we should say that in art historical presentation terms, perhaps, that means on the one hand, this is not either overly built up in a Victorian way or quaint or decorative, mm-hmm. nor is it just all over the map or attempting to be its own piece of art.
Yeah,
trying to be clear here.
Yeah. Let us just contrast for a minute a presentation, let's say, in the Field Museum of Natural History versus this. In the Field Museum, they have a much broader net of concerns, and so they will show economic history and ecology and all of that, and put the art in it as a kind of component in a much larger spectrum of their presentations. But here we're really much more concentrated on showing very selected works that are great artistic accomplishments that will compete well with those objects shown in other galleries in the Art Institute of artistic achievement, and that will also lend themselves to a discussion of how they figure in the way of thought and the religious sphere, principally, of the different cultures. So it's a more reductive and focused kind of presentation.
back to your original question about the continuity of the galleries, this is a wing, and it seemed important that it have architectural continuity and integrity, and we worked together with one architectural firm, Workshop Hakimori Yantrasast, and specifically with Kulupat Yantrasast as the lead architect. He's a student of Tadeo Ando's and is very much informed by the kind of clean, minimalized, very detail-oriented modernist architecture that Ando worked within as well. And Richard and I liked that for the galleries of Indian Art of the Americas and African Art because it really does set a stage where the works of art can be foregrounded and seen in their own right as the wonderful objects that they are. We did take pains within that architectural approach to make a clean break between the Indian Art of the Americas galleries and the African gallery because there's no historical link between these traditions, and we didn't want to imply that there was. We didn't want to go back to the sort of primitive art, Western prototype that we started with 30 years ago, 40 years ago. So there is a large kind of division between the two galleries. We also, within the architecture, we worked to invite the architecture to support the collections as they are different from each other. So in Richard's gallery, we have these large dividing cases. They're called gateway cases that you can pass through. And they were designed to help make a transition from the very, very tall ceilings to the more intimate scale of the works of art. And Richard has many more objects on view of small scale than is seen in the African gallery. In the African gallery, the gateway cases really become open, almost freestanding cases that can be seen on all sides. So one of the priorities in that gallery was for the to have as many sculptural works of art seen in the round as possible. That was something we couldn't do in the previous gallery and seemed very important to do in this new space.
We'll talk about some of these individual pieces and some of the ways that they're shown, but I want to talk a little bit more about the architecture that Kathleen has just brought up. One, when we mention Tadao Ando, a reminder that the very first work by Ando in this hemisphere was the, and remains, the galleries in the Japanese section of the Chinese, Japanese, and Korean galleries, the wonderful Ando Room that Jim Wood and others organized and commissioned and built, where this great simplicity allows one to take in the screens and the pottery. I think right now it's more pottery than screens. The firm also has a great name because between the initials of the two principals and workshop, it's lowercase w, capital H-Y. It's Y. And they also have great names themselves. Now, where is the Y person from originally?
Thailand.
It's a Thai name and a Thai...
Kulupat Yantrasast. The partner is Hashimori, so they workshop Yantrasast Hashimori, and they're based in Los Angeles.
And how did they come to you or you come to them?
They had done a very beautiful installation in Grand Rapids, Michigan, for the Grand Rapids, Michigan Museum. And so that was noted. And there had been some other works around the country. They were recruited with the idea of being specialists in this kind of very clean and clear sorts of presentation.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure there is, if not a temporal, literal narration, some idea of entering the space, but we'll maybe come back to that later. And I'm just curious right now, let's take this random spot that we picked initially because it gave us a place to stand. But maybe that's a good way of sort of testing what you all have accomplished here. You're standing in front of a beer vessel, and I think that you showed, if not this one, some of these other beer vessels in one of your special exhibitions, and we chatted a bit about that. But it's from Peru. And maybe you can give us a sense of where we're standing. And we see textiles looking one way, another large vessel
some gold and stone behind us and other vessels. So,
yes. Well, the general division in the first gallery that you come into, which is the Americas Gallery, has three divisions: North America, then Middle America, Mesoamerica as it's called, beginning with Mexico and running southwards, and then the final section is South America. So we're standing in the South American section. It's defined by three very large containers, one triumphal, painted with the triumphal scenes of military accomplishment by the ancient Nazca of Peru, the other one a great Inca, and we don't know really what that contained. Maybe it contained fermented beer, quite possible, since there's sort of scenes of victory being portrayed.
Involving graphic, some surgical separations of parts of bodies.
Yes, headhunting, in other words. And then in the center case here, a very large Inca aribalos, which is also used for libations, for the present corn libations. And then finally, the vessel that you talked about, which is actually a mid-20th century vessel from the Amazon, from the Shipibo Indians of the Amazon, but it's in that same kind of tradition. And then all around this area are ceramics and metalwork from the different kinds of cultures that made up ancient Peruvian civilization, both on the coast and in the Andes, so each section is very strongly differentiated. One thing that I'd like to point out is the case with textiles. Textiles are an extraordinarily highly developed art in ancient Peru. They knew every technique of weaving that's ever been invented, and so that's a very important part of our collection. And we actually want to amplify that a little bit in the future by putting more textiles in with some of the pottery that you see around here. But all of these things with figures and animals and scenes that illustrate the workings of this ancient world.
The Art Institute also has a great history of textile holdings and a great textile department, which was another belated beneficiary of things moving around into new buildings and so on, that there's again a visible textile section. Do you all work together? Do you compete? Do you share conservatory conservation ideas and storage and so on?
Well, we share. Kathleen will have a little bit more to say about this in a moment, but things used to be much more autonomous. What was textiles was in textiles, and they did their own thing. But gradually, over the years, we evolved a working relationship, and so now they habitually show some of the remarkable holdings, both from the Americas and Africa, in our galleries. And we schedule regularly these pieces to be shown. They're usually, what is it, a three-month period or so? 3 to 4 months. And then they are rotated, and something new is put up. So that, and of course, this is very specialized conservation work, very different from ours, what Kathleen and I normally do, which is more pottery and more wood and things like that. But textiles is very demanding in and of itself, and so they do all the conservation work that's appropriate to those pieces. We have both relied on textile department supporters to buy things that are permitted under law, and also funds from our own committee have been used from time to time.
And we see then that you embrace in these departments, and fortunately now with this enhanced cooperation and support among and across departments, those things that are perhaps some of the most enduring, physically enduring works of art, that brasses or pottery and so on, and then textiles, which along with works on paper are among the most fragile and most sensitive to light, humidity, and air, and now you can bring them together because of advances in conservation and the work that has been done in these cases, and I have to say, your goal, I'm sure, was transparency in more than one way. Oh, yeah. And these cases sort of disappear when you look at the art. You really think you're standing in front of the textile or the vessel, and fortunately you can't reach out and touch them.
I'll just amplify what Richard is saying about the textiles. Richard and I both have always seen the importance of integrating textiles into the presentations of works in the two collections. Textiles are a very specialized and a really important art form in many parts of Africa, as they are in the Americas. The fact that textiles hadn't been on view in the previous galleries really was a result of the shortage of space. So over time, as the collection grew, decisions had to be made about what could and couldn't be exhibited. And at a certain point in the mid-90s, we decided to stop doing a permanent rotation of textiles in the African Gallery. But it was always the intention to reintegrate that when we had more space. So now in the new African Gallery, we have two permanently dedicated locations for the rotation of textiles. They have to rotate because of their greater vulnerability. They are sensitive to light, and so we expose them for 4 months, and then we take them off view for several years and bring in other textiles to be shown. So we have two locations in the African Gallery, two locations in the Indian Art of the Americas Galleries for the permanent rotation of textiles, and they really do add significantly to visually to the character of the presentation, but also enrich the whole sort of understanding that we bring to the aesthetic traditions of these places by having them included. And, you know, we're grateful to the textile department for their cooperation and contribution to making that possible.
And with these new locations, Kathleen Bickford-Berzok has the kind of surprise winner, you could say, in that you have a guest that we're going to talk about that you're able to show because of that location and because of the siting and because of the technical support for that. Richard, were you able to borrow anything, or did you need to borrow anything special for this first installation in your new galleries for the Indian Art of the Americas side?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we could perhaps have gotten by well enough with our permanent collection here, but I also like to include objects from private collections when possible. And so we did borrow some notable pieces to be featured in the new gallery, not a whole lot, but here and there, and with the idea of continuing that option. In some cases, we've sets of things that have been promised to the museum, and the museum partly owns, but also still partly owned by the private collection. So such things, there's some Southwestern ceramics that have fallen in that category, come out and are shown now, but in 6 months or a year, they will go back to the owners, and other pieces will be rotated in. So that's part of it. It's a way of including people who are very committed and interested in these things to be part of the life of the galleries as well.
Tell us about the physical layout of the galleries. There are wooden doorways, one as you enter into the gallery and one that connects the two galleries, and mm-hmm. and both, I would say, just as an observer, they invite you in, mm-hmm. but they also remind you that you're entering a space because they narrow as you come to the actual doorway. So maybe you can tell us a bit about how that was done, and also about how the wood was selected and what the wood is. And there's a very, I don't want to say subtle, I'll say simple use of color as well in the rooms. And maybe we could talk a bit about, maybe we could stroll over to the stand between the doorways, perhaps, and you could describe them. We're speaking with Richard Townsend, who is the chairman of the Department of African Art and Indian Art of the Americas at the Art Institute, and is also curator of the Indian Art and Americas side of that department, and with Kathleen Bickford-Berzok, curator of African Art. art within the department and museum. And we're now standing at an area that angles literally into the African art, and where we also can look all the way out to the entrance and through the Chinese and Korean side of the Chinese, Japanese, and Korean galleries, but we also can get a sense both of these gateway display cases within the Indian art section and also of the larger doorway. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's the same size.
It's the same. Doorway. It's it corresponds. It's slightly different, but of course there's an old existing masonry doorway that's there underneath all of the. That as the entrance, it was served perfectly well as an entrance, but we really wanted to do something that would signal a new gallery. And so the new wooden structure was built around it that has a sense of funneling you in a little bit and can be identified as from afar, from all the way down at the end of the corridor, as something new, a new gallery. For museum goers who may not be familiar with this kind of stuff, they'd see more pottery and they'd think, oh, well, this is more Chinese stuff or something. But we wanted to establish a different domain. And so the same thing in the middle, when we come to the African section, there's another repetition of the main doorway on axis with the first one that, again, brings you into a whole new kind of environment, and you can see how readily people are sort of funneled in, as it were, by these inviting structures. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the wood and how it was chosen, both in terms of form, color, origin.
These details of the color of the wood and the color of the walls and the color of the linen are really important to curators because they're the backdrop for the works of art. I, in particular, was eager to have a light palette in the African gallery for a couple of reasons. One is because largely the collection is darker woods and darker tones, although there's a lot of color in the gallery as well. And my fear was that if we used dark wood in the gallery, those dark-toned works of art would end up looking more like interior decoration and less like the most important thing to see. So I felt that a lighter palette would really complement and foreground the works of art in a helpful way. Another reason why a light palette seemed important was to really signal the way that we are inviting people to see the collection in a new, innovative way. And many people walk into the gallery with the burden of stereotypes and of the media spinning negative impressions of Africa as a place. So having a bright light gallery was really intentionally to separate the collection from any preconceived ideas about a dark continent or scary nighttime sorts of thoughts. So it was very, these sorts of impressions that people walk in with are so powerful and subtle, suggestions that can be made visually in the presentation. I think you walk in and you have a sense of openness, you have a sense of daylight, and like you said earlier, transparency, and that helps invite you to perceive the works of art.
The galleries don't currently have personal names or donor names or historian names, but
no, but we'd love to have that happen.
Those of you who are out there in a position to do that, please do contact Kathleen and Richard. But I have a feeling if somebody did want to name this the Joseph Conrad Heart of Darkness Gallery, that's not what you're looking for.
That definitely wouldn't be what we were looking for. The fact is that so much of the African art, tradition-based African art on view in the gallery is art that was meant to be seen in the daylight, masquerade and royal presentation and all this is really kind of daylight activities in much of Africa. So the lightness of the galleries really makes the collection sparkle and live and breathe in a way that darkness and spotlighting wouldn't.
So the idea of the wood on the floor and in the doorways, it was the question more of this lightness than that it comes from Madagascar or Minnesota or wherever it comes from.
It's just very fresh, very clean.
Yeah, clean.
Now, Richard, you have, I'm not good at specific color names, but you have what would look to me to be a dark green, or I think in the 60s and 70s design era, it might have been called avocado.
It was avocado green, yes. Okay. It's a kind of sage-tinted avocado.
Okay. Right. On the other end, you have a kind of light maroon, perhaps.
It's what's called Indian red.
Oh. I was going to say, but, you know, I thought maybe I'd get drummed out. No, but Indian red, yes.
But these colors are picked out again in the works of art. Mm-hmm. These are sort of earth tones in the end, and so they occur in many of the ceramic vessels, fired on colors, mm-hmm. or otherwise, and in other objects that are shown as well. So there that and the. And the underlying white of most of the gallery walls are within the palette of things shown. We didn't want to get too much into interior decorating and do all of that with cloth and so on and right. so forth. But to have something that warmed up the gallery so it's not so exclusively stark.
The earth tones do that on either end of the room, and then, as you say, there is white on the long walls. Anyone who's decorated a house or even just had to do some refurbishment and repainting, though, knows that there's more than one white available at Benjamin Moore. What is the white here? I'm just curious.
I can't. It's, yeah, something like that. I can't remember the range of some 10 or 12 different whites that one can choose upon, but it has a kind of bone white look. But it's a little bit warm, and it is also picked up in the basic color of the cases, freestanding cases as well.
Now, in the Indian galleries, there is no natural light except for that which comes in mm-hmm. from the quote-unquote old Morton Wing spiral staircase entrance and doorway. What about the lighting that you worked with? Is this a lighting that is found in other parts of the museum, or was this something you all picked specifically for these types of objects?
I believe this may be in some other parts too, but we ordered a whole new set of lights for the galleries. We had some large, more old-fashioned what are called cans with spotlights that are still used elsewhere. They're very effective, but we wanted something that would allow us to focus the light from a greater height and greater distance. So we got new lights, and so they're very small, but they happen to be very intense, and we're still working with it a little bit. This is very much a work of art that will continue to be in progress for some time. So the lighting scheme is really primarily designed to focus on objects within cases. There's not general lighting, but the spillover from it does illuminate the whole gallery.
Mm-hmm. One change before we step into the African room in the structural side of and material side of post-war architecture that is a positive one for sure, but it's one of the few real changes, visible changes, is that there's finally some ceiling material that isn't that styrofoamy looking material that people had to work with literally for decades. And we can all remember in the old Morton Wing and in other parts of the museum, amazing, beautiful, and even experiential abstract installations that culminated when you looked up in the same roof that you ceiling that you had in your schoolroom.
You could see it in the same motels that you spent time in between here and Omaha and the West Coast.
Right.
And
but wherever now you else. Have something that is not Omaha Motel ceiling material, and that allows, I think, for a much more elevated feeling in these spaces.
Thank you.
Music to accompany our two-part stroll through these wonderful new permanent galleries of Indian Art of the Americas and African Art at the Art Institute of Chicago. As we told you at the beginning of the hour, we're going to go now to a piece of next week's interview that concerns a rare and magnificent textile. We're doing this because this textile is only on view for reasons of limiting light and light damage, fragility, environmental issues for the work, etc. The work is only up through this Sunday, November 6th. So you'll hear this part again next week, but we want to encourage you to get over there at least to see the spiders. And maybe you can think about a spider and a fly.
I bring you the great, gorgeous, gigantic overture known as the Web Song. You've never heard it by Tchaikovsky. You never heard it by Rimsky-Korsakov, because they didn't know any better. But now, I bring you one of yours truly, Little Fats Waller's Spider and the Fly. I'm coming out of the web. Be careful now. I'll vamp you in. Won't you come into my parlor? Send the spider to the fly. I've the cutest little living room that you did ever spy. Oh, fly, bye-bye, bye-bye. Oh, fly, because she walked into his parlor, unsuspecting little fly. Please come in, my fine young maiden. Let me rest your dainty hat. We'll have tea out on the terrace and a friendly little chat. Oh, fly, bye-bye, bye-bye. Oh, fly, because she walked into his parlor, unsuspecting little fly. My art collection, it's the best that gold can buy. Not to speak of my fine etchings that will surely please your eye. Oh, fly, bye-bye, bye-bye.
We do want to come to a work that is not a part of the collection here, but that is a part of the installation, very much so, because as you were telling us earlier, you now can show the textiles in a featured way and in an appropriate way visually and in terms of conservation. And you have a work here that, from the point of view of art, of natural history, and of craft and design, is an overused word, unique in each of those ways, and sort of becomes a braiding of unique qualities, and it's also extremely striking. And that is a very special textile from Madagascar.
That's right. We have, as a very special loan in celebration of the opening of the new gallery, a work from Madagascar. It is a large brocaded textile that's made entirely from the silk of the golden orb spider. And it is absolutely unique in the world. The men who are the creators of the textile, Simon Piers and Nicholas Godley, have worked with a team of 80 Malagasy weavers and spider silk collectors to make a couple other smaller objects as well, or textiles as well. But this is a very large, very elaborate textile, and it is woven in the form of a traditional Highland Malagasy luxury textile called a lamba. For textile aficionados, it is brocaded in two directions, so it's really a tour de force of weaving, and the material it's made from is just mind-boggling. It took 5 years to collect enough spider silk to make this textile and then to weave it. And weaving with spider silk is very challenging, as you can imagine. It's one of the strongest naturally occurring materials in the world, but its strength is all in its elasticity. It's very, very fine. Spider silk is 10 times finer than a human hair. And so in every warp strand, that's the strands that run horizontally and create the sort of length of the textile, each one has, I believe it's 96 strands of spider silk spun together to make each warp. Each brocading weft has 360 strands of spider silk spun together. It's just monumental to think of accumulating enough spider silk to make this, and it's really magnificent object. It was completed in 2009, so it's a work of contemporary art, and it poses a lot of interesting questions in terms of what is Africa and what is African art and where is it going?
Just what is the situation of the golden orb spider population now that over a million of them were used or their work was used to make this work?
Yeah. No golden orb spider was killed in the making of this textile. No, I should say that the golden orb spider creates spider silk, which is a magnificent golden color. And so this textile is just a luminous gold, and that is the natural color of the spider silk. The spiders are collected daily, and the silk is extracted, and then they're re-released. It is not harmful to the spider, and it's very time-consuming. Spiders are notoriously difficult to capture and work with. They bite. So they're quite large. The female golden orb spider is about the size of the human hand. And for anybody who might want more information about the textile, we did make a video about the textile, its history, its making, and that's available if you go to the Art Institute's website on the exhibition page for the golden spider silk textile. There's a link to that video, and it'll give you a lot more information about it.
Music we heard this evening came from the Navajo people, from Mali in West Africa, from Mr. Thomas Fats Waller, composer, writer, and performer. And when we go out in a moment, our buddies, they might be giants. We'd like to thank Kathleen Bickford-Borzac and Richard Townsend for giving so much of their time and for giving their life's work, really, to the people of Chicago and the people of the world through these collections, all the scholarship, the exhibitions, and now these new galleries at the Art Institute. We'd like to thank Chai Lee of the Art Institute for helping us make this program happen. We'd like to thank our funders, Alpha Wood Foundation, Richard and Susan Kiphart, and other friends of this program. We'd like to thank Matt DeStefano for both recording the walkthrough at the museum and also, of course, putting the program together and making it sound great. Drop us a line. Let us know what you thought of this or any of our other programs. You can visit the Chime In feature at WFMT.com. Give it a click. Or drop us an old-fashioned email like in the last century at Rentap. That's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com. You can hear this or any of our programs anytime, WFMT.com/critical thinking, where you can experience the always and ever free Critical Thinking podcast. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week. Look out for spiders.
Ladies and gentlemen. Our hero. Spider.
rid of Spider. Step on Spider! Spider! We love you, Spider. I promise not to kill you. Spider! Spider! We love you, Spider. Spider! Get rid of Spider! Stop! Spider! He is our hero.